All right, welcome back to the Weekly Paphist. Mm-hmm. We're your hosts, Giovanni Del Piero, Michael Pekka, and we're back again.
Again, yes, after another long break.
we were both separated and both doing our own stuff for a while, and we considered trying to do some stuff with YouTube Live or almost like a Zoom call, but tech-wise, that wasn't going to work, and also I don't know what it would have done to our tech stuff.
Plus, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, no. So we decided we would just wait for a little bit, and then once Michael got back, we would just send out some episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So
we're not going to release them all at once, but we're going to be, over the course of the next few days, we're going to be doing like 4 episodes.
Yeah.
And then we're going to be releasing them periodically.
Yeah, just so we could
get caught up.
Yeah, and we don't want to send them all out once too, because that would kill Michael's computer, and we don't want to do that right before school, but... Yeah, this one's just a more, casual, what's the day? Wednesday? Yeah,
casual Wednesday.
The next one, we'll be talking about a certain document that Francis sent out that might have made some people upset.
And we're really getting there right on top of right when it was released, a few weeks.
Yeah, only a few weeks late, And then after that, we'll be going over another encyclical. And then after that, the episode will be the long-awaited review of the Engelbert Dollfuss book, which I think has a lot of lessons that really can, that we can learn from, that we can apply to like our own current situation.
Definitely. I think that's a very, that's a very good insight. And I think there's a lot of connections we can make between Dollfuss's Austria and kind of the American modern conservative, in paths they can both pass the one that the American conservative needs to start taking, and we can use Dollfuss as kind of perhaps like not necessarily a guide, but like an example to like point out things that went right and things that went wrong.
Because even though obviously it was during, or at least right up to World War II, so the circumstances were certainly different from ours, but there's still a lot of similarities that make it so his life and his plan, we can sort of, like you said, learn from the mistakes, pick what was right, and reject what was wrong. He was not all perfect, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But anyway, so I guess the first thing is, Michael, what have you been up to these past few weeks?
Yeah.
you left me to go to Texas.
Oh. I apologize for that. I was actually the TA for a summer program called O'Hara, and that basically just is like a... So for this year, because of COVID, they had to slightly modify it. In the past, it would be Gen Chem 1 and Gen Chem 2 over the course of 8 weeks. Now it's just Gen Chem 1, so over the course of 4 weeks.
God, yeah, I was going to say, I was like, I knew it was definitely shorter than the 8 week version.
Yeah, so I was just the TA, so basically like I would have to just be around, and I would help grade like lab reports and help run the labs. And then just be around to answer questions for chemistry. Okay. And that really was pretty much it.
Well, because I remember I was talking to a friend about it, and it seemed like it was almost identical to just a regular class routine. Because you were doing office hours, right, for kids?
Yeah, I was doing office hours, but like, I think it was important to realize that any attempt that I will do to like regiment my schedule into like big block, like, probably was not the most practical way for me to go about it. Just like, oh, I'll be around from like 5 to like 11, like, or 7 to 11 rather.
Okay,
but like, I was like,
wow.
But then like at times like 10:30, I'm like, I'm done. Like, I can't. Like, it's just like,
it is not gonna happen.
It's just not gonna happen. So I was around. I didn't really follow my schedule too much. Apologies. But I think I did an all right job. I think I did an okay job. I'm satisfied with how I did, and I think most people are pretty happy with how the program turned out.
Despite COVID,
yeah.
Did you, when you were around the age of the participants, did you do O'Hara? Like, did you participate in the program at all before UD?
So I was going to actually do it, but then because of COVID, they had to stop. So I would have done it. Which really messes up a lot of things for my courses, because with O'Hara under my belt, I would have been able to do my organic chemistry courses freshman year.
So you would have been like almost a year ahead.
I would have been a year ahead in my chemistry course. Wow. But because of, COVID, they couldn't do that. But what's going to happen now is my organic chemistry path is going to be broken up because of Rome. So this upcoming fall, I'm doing OChem 1. Okay. Then we're both going to Rome in the spring. But then when I come back, I still need to do that OChem 2 before the junior fall. Because I need to take other chemistry courses and just do my other sciences. So one of the professors, actually, Dr. Dannett, may potentially be offering like a summer class on organic chemistry too. For the spring Romers, which would be so nice. That'd be so nice.
Yeah, because then you don't have to rush to get these other classes done, and it's not the extra stress. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but so you have to take a certain number of classes, and what's the test called that you have to take?
MCAT.
MCAT, the one. Okay. So I've heard it before, and I'm like, that does not sound fun at
all. It'll be interesting, to say the least. Yeah. Who knows? Who knows?
The kids that participate in this program, I imagine, are all, going to be like some of the top people in their class to some extent. I mean, because they're,
I would agree with that. Yeah. I think it's going to be different just because like a lot of them are going to be now in Gen Chem 2. And one girl is going to be in organic chemistry because she already had the creds for Gen Chem. So I think just going to be a bit different. They're going to be younger.
Okay.
I think than the average Gen Chem 2 student, but they're going to be like a whole class ahead compared to like other freshmen.
Wow. Okay.
So like, yeah, I think they'll be doing quite well.
I mean, great for them. Cause that mean they're getting ahead and obviously they're up to the challenge. Cause they're going to be doing, those STEM classes are a lot of work on their own, mm-hmm. plus getting adjusted to the core and all that other fun stuff. So that's going to be, it's going to be a fun
time. I don't envy them, but we'll see what happens.
You're just like, good luck. It's been real. But
well, how about you? What have you been up to? So you just finished your program, right?
Yeah. So I may have mentioned this at one point, probably in an earlier show. Earlier this, pretty much from, I'd say early June to like the beginning of August, I was doing this thing called the Academy, which is an online program with the Heritage Foundation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is a very prominent conservative think tank.
Mm-hmm.
And, you applied for this thing and you were with a bunch of other students and you basically listened to speakers. You got to talk to them and listen to speakers. And then what you would do is the program assigned you what are known as cohorts. Mm-hmm. So you do small group discussions that were based on a topic that was like your top interest. So for me, I was with kids in a group that was called Life, Marriage, and Religious Liberty, which, that says weekly papist all over it.
Right, right.
But, this is kind of, again, to my, critique. I did graduate from the program because I attended enough of the sessions and whatnot, so that was good.
Congratulations.
I can add that to the resume. But and my small group discussions were very good. It was a mix of, Newman Guide, Catholic school kids, and then people who, for example, were evangelicals who went to like Liberty University.
Okay.
So it was, even though there are some theological differences, at least on the major issues, we were in pretty solid agreement mm-hmm. overall. The rest of the kids, however, was a different story because a lot of them kind of followed the more, it was funny, they were so rank and file and yet so extreme at the same time. Because like they took the standard conservative position, but took it to its logical conclusions. So like you had people saying stuff, for example, like, oh yeah, we should privatize the environment. Mm-hmm. Should I read the quotes?
Actually, yeah, go and read the quote, yeah.
So at one point, I showed this to some people just to give an idea. I copied down some quotes from people, because we have when speakers, so like you watch pre-recorded videos of the speakers, and then they would appear in a live Q&A, and so people could go on and ask questions. So there's like a live chat on the side. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to copy down some smash hits that were just too good to pass up. So I titled this Cringe Quotes. And basically, these are things that are either cringe, wrong, or insane. And this just sort of gives you an idea of where the conservative movement is potentially headed if things do not shape up.
Okay, so, let's hear some of them. Let's hear this one.
Since our bodies are our property, stuff like prostitution should be legal. Okay. Privatize the environment. Most Catholics are just socialists at prayer. That's a good one. The Bible says nothing about the government helping those in need. Always stand with Israel, no matter what. Non-interventionism doesn't work. Just look at Hitler. Right. Like, it's, you know, yeah, because Hitler's armies storming across Europe and, you know, ragtag jihadists in Afghanistan with, like, Soviet-era weaponry are comparable. We need American troops overseas to help keep the global economy running. Charlie Kirk is doing great things for America. Okay, I will give him this. At a recent TPUSA conference, he did invite Sohrab Ahmari to speak. So who knows? Maybe Redemption Arc? Who knows? This one was from a speaker. The Reformation was one of the best things to happen to the West.
Oh, yeah. Oh, lovely. That's awesome.
Christendom gone just like that. This was just one that you heard over and over again. The greatest threat facing America is China. And our cohort leader actually complimented our group on this, because the most common threat, or like the greatest challenge, we would say, was something along the lines of like moral decay and just overall spiritual societal collapse. And she was like, I'm glad you guys said that, because literally every other group said China.
Right.
You know, and like, they would bring this up for any topic. Like, the speaker would be talking about how to get a job, and someone would in the chat would somehow throw in, like, we got to stop China. And then the last one, Ayn Rand is one of my personal heroes. Yeah,
Beautiful. Very conservative philosopher.
You know, pro-abortion, hardcore atheist, you know. But yeah, that's great.
Right. Wow. So, well, I know we talked about this a little bit. So, I'm just going to throw this idea off you and I hear your thoughts. Like, it really seems to me that there are two pathways that the modern conservative movement is going to go down. Mm-hmm. I think the logical conclusion of separation of church and state is going to be in one of the camps. So, I think, like, you know, like, the religious influence should be only within like the private sphere of your own life with your own family, maybe. And then you have the religious, or you have the political and the public sphere, and those two should never interact or co-mingle. They should be very separate.
Yeah.
I think you can see this a lot with kind of like the modern libertarian, you know, like
even the religious ones
to some extent. Yeah. And I think this is kind of where you see like a lot of like perhaps like more atheist and non-Christian conservatives. And by conservative, I mean like small government, free market. They tend to be, at least from what I've noticed, they tend to be pretty okay with like abortion to an extent, or pretty okay with like, you know, like gay marriage, because right. You know, you can't interfere with other people's life decisions.
I remember Trump was like, I'll be the most like pro LGBT candidate we've ever had, or right. You know, something like that.
Yeah, so I think like we kind of see like the logical conclusion of separation of church and state going to its like final like logical end. And then I think on the other end, you kind of have conservatives who, for lack of a better term, are like finally waking up, like kind of understanding that, you know, perhaps separation of church and state isn't the best idea. You need to have a politics that's informed by like a religious and like a moral background. And it's perfectly okay for like your religious convictions to dictate public policy. So I think we kind of see that a lot with more like a way, like, you know, a lot more religious conservatives, integralists, perhaps. Obviously, I think these are two very broad camps, and obviously a lot of people are going to fall in the middle, or even just continue to just be neocons with small government.
Or
a mixture of both, even, which is possible. But I think this is kind of what I've noticed a lot, and like, you know, you interacting with those individuals, the heritage, what, like, would you say that's an accurate depiction?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. I mean, even with, because, you know, like I said, it was a mix of Catholics, and then, for example, you had people who were Baptist or Presbyterian or whatnot, and even if they weren't so big on the idea of like, oh, your politics being influenced by religion, there was still a general understanding that like, it's not, you need to have a religious foundation for your society, because if you don't, anything goes, and it just allows any sort of ideology you follow to completely transform to whatever it wants to be, because there isn't that solid ground. And you saw this too, because, like, for example, one issue that came up was, you know, large tech companies or corporations, you know, for example, suppressing right-wing speech or banning books such as Dr. Ryan Anderson's book on transgenderism. Mm-hmm. And basically the general consensus was, oh, that's bad, but they're a private business, so there's nothing we can do and nothing we should do. And it's really just a loser mentality.
Right, yeah.
More than anything. But I think that's a correct assessment on your part, because if you, like I said, if you completely, and I don't like using this term entirely, but, like, you know, the if you take away the, like, Judeo-Christian heritage and values from the conservative movement, it's going to cease to be conservative within the long run. And we've seen the end results of this. I mean, you've seen groups invite, like, for example, Atheists for Liberty.
Right,
and you've seen a toleration of things that would be unthinkable, you know, 10, maybe 20 years ago.
Right, and they tend to only support, like, two conservative positions. Small government, free market.
And, and they might be pro-life to an extent, and maybe they'll have... Oh, immigration's kind of a tricky issue.
There's like a lot of variety on that topic.
But yeah, it's just this thing where it's, to them, being conservative is like, I love capitalism, I hate the government, and maybe I'm pro-life. But other than that, and even with the pro-life thing, you know, some of them, they're like, yeah, I'm personally pro-life, but I don't think the government should intervene. So it's, you know,
right.
You're going to see, like, it's like the David French type conservatism, where you're like, oh, I'm a principled conservative, so I'm going to argue for why we should teach CRT in schools.
Right, and, right.
You know, why we shouldn't use the state to ban stuff like Drag Queen Story Hour. Like, that's a blessing of liberty.
Well, that reminds me of that one Rod Drahir article you sent me the other day, which said, like, the only solution to conservatism in the long run is to begin to utilize the institutions, so, like, the state, the cultural institutions,
media,
Kind of like the exact same way that, like, the liberals have been like experts at utilizing these tools for their advantage. And, like, Absolutely. That's the thing, like, liberals are not dumb. Like, I don't know where this idea keeps popping up. Like, no, like,
they might be wrong ideologically, but when it comes to actually holding on to power and using it
in an effective way, they are masterful at doing this. And I think in a way, like, I was talking about this with a friend the other day, like, conservatives from different camps are just simply unable to coalition and present an effective buttress against progressives. Because a lot of progressives, like, and at least for the short term, they can reconcile their differences and, like, find common ground and build off of that. I don't see conservatives doing that. And I think it has to do with the fact, like, I think it has to do with kind of, like, perhaps, like, the honor system. Like, for the conservatives, like, they cannot go back on their views, even if it means, like, something worse comes because of that. Like, I've noticed a lot with, like, back in Vatican II, for instance, as an example, like, the liberal, for lack of a better term, obviously there aren't really liberal or conservative factions in the church, but just because it's easier to think of them this way.
Yeah.
The liberal coalition was able to, they were able to find unity and really just bolster their movements and push forward a lot of propositions, they weren't heretical, but they were, like, they're able, you know, like, they were ambiguous, so they could interpret them in a favorable way to their own positions.
Yeah.
But then you have the conservatives who were just not able to do that, and, like, a lot of them, they got, you know, absolutely steamrolled by these individuals. So I think we're seeing that a lot now as well. Like, conservatives are simply unable to, like, find common ground. Obviously, big tent conservatism is a whole other issue, but, like,
you make that good point, because, I mean, you look at and this is where I actually do find some hope, is that, okay, you look at what are the two major visions for the GOP right now? You have option one, which is your, like, classical, you know, principled, quote-unquote, neoconservatism of, like, George W. Bush and Meghan McCain and David French and whatnot. Or you have, on the other hand, the deformed remnants of the Trump camp run by people like Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Tyler Greene, who's crazy, and, you know, stuff like, you know, the deep state is coming for you, and Trump rioters did nothing wrong, and, like, that whole camp.
Right, right.
Which is bad, obviously, because neither of those two people are, neither of those two camps are good. However, what I'm very curious to see the results of is Tucker Carlson's recent trip to Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
Because what my ideal scenario would be is that he uses his influence to sort of push like a modified Hungarian model for American conservatives.
That would be really interesting to see.
Because, I mean, think about it. Carlson has a very major platform. And mm-hmm. he wasn't the only one there. Roger Hare was there, who's Orthodox. Mm-hmm. Gladden Papin is there now, who's Catholic. And Tucker, who's Episcopalian, is also there. So,
wow, kind of like, it's like, funny. Like
yeah,
that.
You're all, it really should tell you something if all three of them happen to be looking to this one place for inspiration. And I don't think Hungary's perfect, but there needs to be some sort of platform going forward.
Right. And I probably should have mentioned this. The Roger Hare article I was mentioning was talking about Tucker Carlson going to Hungary and yeah. kind of like the Hungarian method of actually using the state and the institutions to promote like their ideology. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wanted to circle back to this. Like a lot of times people will complain that like the church should not be the church is a spiritual, like a lot of Catholics I will notice argue this point, like the church is a spiritual institution and should not involve herself in politics.
No.
Because politics like will like dirty like the church. And to an extent, like I agree, right? The church should ennoble politics. The church should refocus politics in order to bring about like the social kingship of Christ, right?
Yeah.
To bring about there are objectively Christian policies and non-Christian policies, right?
Right.
The church advocating for abortion to be illegal, that's a church taking a political stance on an issue. It's a moral and political issue. They're not mutually exclusive.
I mean, if you're a proponent of Catholic social justice, well, you are admitting that Catholicism is inherently political to an extent.
Right, exactly. And I think the problem is when the church just merely becomes a vehicle of political power and influence. That's the problem. But the church shouldn't just remove herself from politics completely. The church has morals that it would like to see enshrined in society. And how do you do that? Through the culture, through the state, through the society.
Through evangelization.
And that's how, like...
Yeah, it's I've mentioned this before, like, it's absurd to think that Christ only meant for his mission to be completed through, like, you know, like he said, you know, spread the gospel to all creatures and keep my commandments. But if you're in power and you're in office, you can't do that, because that's imposing a religion on others. Like, that's...
Right.
That's absurd. Obviously,
like, you have to protect the freedom of conscience of other individuals, mm-hmm. and you can't force them to become Catholic. But there are Christian policies that you should promote if you are a Christian ruler. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's at all controversial to say that.
Well, there's such a double standard, too, because they really only apply that to, like, issues of marriage and unborn life. It's like, okay, if we took it to its logical conclusion, like, you're a Christian politician, then you couldn't pursue policies that help the poor or protect the environment or any of that, because is that not technically imposing your religion on other people?
Right, exactly. And I think a lot of times it's really funny to, like, I think for, like, you know, like, liberals or, like, other, like, non-Christians to assume that, oh, it's just so easy to separate your religious convictions from the convictions of, like, the voter bloc who voted you in, and you should be able to separate the two. Like, it's not how, like...
No.
It's not...
You're...
The religious conviction isn't something you just put on in the morning and take off at night, you know? Like...
Yeah, it doesn't... All politics is morality, right? Your political decisions are an extension of morality, and your morality is going to be based off of, hopefully, at least, your religious views. And if you're a Catholic, that's what's going to end up looking like. You can't... Yeah, like you say, you can't just separate the two. They're going to be intertwined one way or another. You may not think it is, you may not notice it, but in one way or another, it will always connect back to that.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
I want to ask you this question, because I know, because in the, oh, I wanted to kind of segue into this, because I got a book review published during
the
time.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And, you know, in it, I posed the question of, you know, how are Catholics going to vote in the future? Because obviously you could reform the GOP, but it's a highly corporatized party, and the likelihood, I think, of getting it to a to like a desirable point is going to be very difficult. It could happen, but it'd be a long run. So then, of course, poses the question, well, what about a third party? And it's like, it is something I've been, you know, thinking about recently. Like, you know, if the GOP doesn't improve itself in the next few years before the election, or they put forward someone that's very just, you know, like just not great, like do we jump ship and join someone like the American Solidarity Party?
Well, I think you had a good, I read your article and you had a good point at the end where you said you either have a GOP, which I don't really think you can reform that well now, because mm-hmm. there's just too many different ideological variances within that will make it very hard to like shift the public platform of the GOP. Mm-hmm. So to that extent, like, you're right, the GOP is gonna, I would say, like, whereas the liberals are complete, are like, whereas the Democratic Party, for instance, is immoral and wrong on several issues, I think the GOP is misguided on several issues. I think there's definitely a difference of morality between the two parties. So to that extent, like, you're gonna be forced to vote for a party which wins, which is the GOP. At least they win right now, mm-hmm. which has misguided principles that don't really follow Christian social teaching to that. You know, so you have that option.
Yeah.
Then you have the third party option, which will never win on the national level. Maybe perhaps if you just like a large block or like a large like coalition within like your own city, you might win a few city council seats or whatever mm-hmm. to support, you know, smaller policies on the local level. But you will never win a presidency. You'll never win like a seat in Congress. Yeah. You just won't.
Right.
So I think for the short term, at least for the next few years, I think the GOP is probably going to collapse. At least if it hasn't already collapsed, it's like the edifice is still standing, like for right now, but like it can't sustain itself in the long run.
No.
So I think we're going to have to be voting for the GOP at least for the short term, and then for like local level third party, third party candidates, provided that there's a reasonable chance of winning.
Yeah.
So I think that happened a lot with the 2020 election. I think a lot of people voted for third party candidates. That had no chance of winning, and I think a lot of them kind of regret it now, with like Biden being elected.
Yeah, well, so it's like you make the good point that like in the short term, there won't be any chance. But because like the argument that I've heard from people is like, well, if you want to see political change, you kind of have to be that change first, and so that means by like voting for a party that you know will not win in the next few years, but then maybe like 20 years down the road has a bigger chance. But even then, I'm like, just
think about how the societal and political landscape has changed within like the past like year, even. Like so much has changed in the past year that I think like taking a principled, slow approach for 20 years before you can finally start seeing some results,
maybe,
is just not a good idea. Because at that point, will we even have like an identifiable country and ethos?
Right.
At that point, it's going to be more local. I think it's going to be more localized around either like the state or like by the party.
Mm-hmm.
Like as America as like a unifying principle, I don't think is going to be around.
Or at least it's
for that much
it's
longer.
It's on the way out.
It's on the way out. 20 years, I think. In 20 years, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, it scares me to some extent because it's like I don't.
20 years ago, like.
20 years ago, things were relatively fine. I mean, it wasn't great, but it was definitely a lot better.
Well, I mean, think about 20 years ago, California almost passed the Marriage Defense Act.
And now look at it.
And now, like that was only 20 years ago. It was less than 20 years ago. That was, like, what, 2004, right? Something around there.
Think about it. 20 years from now, we could be sitting in a chair, and it's like, you know, you're listening to this from the Second Republic of Texas, you know, we're your hosts. Like,
Well, that's what I mean. Like, it's just, like, so much has changed in the past, like, 15 years, and we're only going to... That change is not going away anytime soon.
No, it's not.
So, who knows, man? I don't know.
Yeah, well, there was something I forget. But the one thing, though, that sort of brightened my spirits this morning was opening up Twitter to find a tweet from the Democrats for Life saying that based Joe Manchin single-handedly saved the Hyde Amendment during the passing of the infrastructure bill because he was like the lone Democrat who voted with the Republicans to keep it.
Yeah,
which that's insane. That made my morning. Like I was like, You know, Weekly Papist officially salutes Joe Manchin, the Democrats for life. Keep up the good work.
I can't believe that happened.
I mean, literally, there was at one point, I remember, I was pretty blackpilled about that. I'm like, they're going to remove the Hyde Amendment, the Equality Act's going to get passed, and, you know, religious freedom as we know it will be dead. And then it's like, Joe Manchin comes in and just single-handedly stops all of their plans. Like, right.
Well, I will say, is he ever going to get reelected?
Probably not.
Probably not.
You're going to get some, like, AOC wannabe. He's going to be like, you know, stop, you're oppressing me.
And, you're right.
You know, it goes from there. But, yeah, it's going to be the next, honestly, even just the next, like, 5 or so years is going to be a wild ride. Just
it is.
What,
it will.
Because, you know, like, what I'm curious to see, because what I found out recently was that Ron DeSantis is a Catholic, which I didn't know. So, depending on how GOP
that
running
would be
goes.
Self-interesting.
Like, because you could either have, okay, you could have him as VP and Trump run against Biden again, or you could have, for the first time in American history, a papist showdown between DeSantis and Joe Biden.
It's like, I'm kind of like nerding out a little bit. A little bit. Like, cool. I know it's a serious issue, but just like two Catholics going at it just
for the
in the political arena. And we're going to see like the news media's argue which one is a better Catholic.
Oh, yeah. You know, like, absolutely. I mean, not that they're both of them have their issues, but just it's like.
No, but you know what we're going to see? It's we're going to see the comparisons between the different Catholic faiths. Mm-hmm. Even though Catholics themselves only make like, what, 20% of the American population, you know that's going to be like a major thing.
Every Protestant in the nation is going to be seething through us at this point. Yeah, like, entire thing. You're like, no! I can imagine like all the like reformed people like Todd Friel and James White just going like absolutely bananas.
It really reminds me of some kind of like European civil war between like the different houses of nobility. Like, I just complete nerding out about this. Like,
JFK just smile. Well, he just is like, you know, the conquistador's dream has finally come to fruition. But
yeah, I don't know. I'm curious.
The thing with DeSantis, that's there's two things that worry me there. Like, from a purely political point of view, what I'm worried is he's going to be like, assuming he ends up being the main candidate that runs, right? He's going to be like, I'm carrying the torch for Trump, you know, America First 2.0, we're going to do all this and that. And then first day in office, he, you know, cuts taxes for corporations that persecute the right and then, you know, sends troops back to Afghanistan or something.
You think it's going
to
happen? Well, I thought, wasn't Trump pulling out in the Middle East?
He was, but there weren't.
That's kind of one thing I think Biden did a good job of actually. Like, yeah, just doing, like I'm giving credit where credit is due. Pulling us
the
out.
The neocons
of
a, were like.
Well, pulling us out of a no-win situation in the Middle East where we like are losing like a lot of soldiers, a lot of money, a lot of resources.
It's the longest
for no
war
gain.
We've ever had in our nation's history.
Yeah, and we've gained nothing from that.
Yeah, it's they don't call it the graveyard of empires for nothing. Like,
right.
It's, well, and then there's the question too. Like, okay. He might be a good president, but will he be a good Catholic one? Because that's the thing with JFK. It's like, yeah, he was definitely a great president, but I mean, he was very adamant about separate. And I understand the circumstances at the time were slightly different because of the overwhelming sort of Protestant consensus against him. But even then, he was like, you know, my Catholicism won't inform my politics at all.
Right. That's an interesting thing to think about. I didn't really think about, I suppose I should have been thinking about that. I haven't really thought about that. But another thing to consider is who the Pope's going to be if that happens.
That is true.
Because
down the road, I mean, I don't know. I think Francis would still be alive.
4 years, 3 years, I guess. I think he still will be.
He would have to make a decision about that. Because,
right.
I mean, think about it. Obviously he could make the case that, well, DeSantis is going against Catholic teaching on something like immigration and the environment, but like, abortion though tops those issues.
Yeah, and if the Pope comes out and like against DeSantis for these issues, like
Biden
has a much more strong stance against way more grievous matters that you
marriage
know nothing about
too,
it.
Gender. I mean, I'll be very curious. Assuming Francis is still around, I'd be very curious to see how he goes about that. Because that, I mean, that really puts him in a tough situation. Mm-hmm. So seeing how Papa Francesco goes about this one. But
so, okay. That was Heritage Foundation. Bit of a long talk about that. Yeah. What else have you been up to? So that was what, last week it was over?
Pretty much. Yeah, it ended last week. They did their little graduation ceremony, and I got my, they emailed me my like little, what's it
certificate?
Called? Certificate. Okay. Yeah, so I'll keep that or something in case
you're going to frame it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Since I'm so proud of my time there. I totally didn't want to slam my head against the wall after every other session. But
did you know what you're getting into?
Yes and no. I knew I would be a minority as far as a lot of that stuff goes, but like the thing with Heritage is, yeah, they've always had a libertarian sort of economic bent, which, okay, fair enough, but they always were really solid on social issues. They're very solidly pro-life. They always did good stuff about the family and about marriage. But my concern was just hearing a lot of these other kids, like, that doesn't seem to be the case. Like, there's one kid I remember just flat out said, all politics is just really just economics. Like, the economy is everything. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's a very
materialistic approach.
Just not a good way to look at things. But, you know, it's what it's now I know. Right? Like, at least we know what we're up against, and I don't know to what extent this affects other conservative groups, but mm-hmm. my hopes are not particularly high. But we have to remain optimistic, you know, and all that. But other than that, though, I've mostly just been working. I've been reading a lot as well.
Mm-hmm. What are you reading right now?
So I'm reading right now, it's actually, I just recently finished Sohrab Ahmari's book, The Unbroken Thread. It was his new one that came out. Mm-hmm. Very good. Definitely should read it. But what I'm reading now is a very interesting thesis. So it's a book by a man named Andrew Willard Jones. It's called The Two Cities. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book originally called Before Church and State, which is about Catholic France and sort of how the temporal and spiritual worked together. And he and Jacob Imam are the two founders of the site New Polity.
Right, yeah.
Which is very good. But in this book, what he basically argues is that all of Western history, and by extension, human history, is really just a history of the Catholic Church. Hmm. Because the way he says it, he's like, the Catholic Church is not just another player on the field of history. He's like, the Church is the field of history. And that, mm-hmm. like, the incarnation of Christ is, like, the central event of human history, and that everything that comes after is, in one way or another, a result of that. Or either it's a result, everything is either a result of people adhering to the incarnation, or it's people going away from it. Hmm. And I'm only on the part called, it's called the Age of Grace, which basically is right after sort of, it's basically, this is the beginning of the New Testament era. So it's a really, there was actually a podcast of two students from, I think it was Franciscan. Hmm. They interviewed Andrew Willard Jones, because I think he teaches there. I can check that real quick. Yeah, he's the director of Catholic Studies at Franciscan University of Steubenville.
Okay.
And I listened to part of the interview, and it's really interesting.
So how would he, I don't know if you've, obviously, you've only, looks like only like a few pages in, but how would he respond to someone say, well, what about, say, like the Native American tribes that didn't hear about Christ until 1,500 years after the incarnation? How would he respond to that?
Well, the way, interesting way, because he talked about the nation of Israel, at least in this context, and the way he said it, he's like, you have to understand that at least by the time of David, there was beginning to be a recognition that the law of Israel was not exclusive, mm-hmm. right? Like when time of Moses, it was understood this law is just for the law of it, for Israel, but that with David and what came after that, there was beginning to be a recognition that this law was meant to be applied universally. Mm-hmm. And so in a similar way that, for example, God would elect judges to be role models for the people of Israel, God chose the nation of Israel to be a light to all nations, because mm-hmm. after the Tower of Babel, people were separated. And so, because he's like, if that wasn't the case, then God would have to have to do a similar thing for all of the world's peoples. But instead, you create a role model in one country that others can adhere to. And so I am obviously curious to see how he responds to, like, you know, for example, that claim with the Native Americans, because I imagine he might say something like, well, the law just hadn't reach them by that point, or that, you know, they could at least adhere to some aspects of like natural revelation.
Right, right. Kind of like existed in potency, if not in act, until mm-hmm. it was later actualized by right. the missionaries. Okay, interesting.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know if I'll complete, and the other thing he mentioned too is he said this is mostly focusing on the Latin church.
Right.
So
right.
stuff involving like orthodoxy or the Nestorians will not be as
prominent. Yeah. Okay, interesting. I wonder what the Orthodox, their view kind of on like integralism or like church and state. Cause it seems like they don't only have a set viewpoint on it. So I imagine they can probably be pretty fluid.
Yeah, I mean,
which has its pros and cons.
Right. Like I imagine if you talk to the more on, like I know like Jay Dyer has, like he's for a more like Orthodox version of integralism, and you know, like, and he used the example of like the Orthodox double-headed eagle mm-hmm. with the two swords. Like one represents the temporal, one represents the spiritual, both acting in concord with one another. Mm. So I don't know though how like they're patriarchs. I know some of them are definitely more traditional than others, but it's probably varies across the board. But
I would imagine so. Okay, interesting.
Yeah, so that's the one I'm reading now. I will get back to us on, or to the podcast to how it ends up being, because I'm okay. curious to see how he sort of goes about that. But other than that, it was kind of a random mix of stuff, some religious, some political.
Anything that's super major, or is it just smaller?
Yeah, like there was one work I read relatively recently, which I thought was pretty good, was it was On the Acquisition of the Holy Spirit by St. Seraphim of Sarov.
Oh, okay.
Which was really interesting. He was a post schism Orthodox saint, but didn't really have anything much to do with the actual schism itself. And the way I read it, it's because the way it's written, it's a dialogue from a man who met with Seraphim. And he was able to sort of communicate his advice to him, and so it was like, it's just a dialogue.
Oh, basically. Interesting.
Yeah, huh. But it's very well written. It's pretty short too.
Like how many, like 40 pages?
Yeah, like you can go. There are a few Orthodox sites online that have okay. it, so you can, you know,
go behind. Check that out.
You can go behind enemy lines and go read it. But it's pretty applicable to all Christians, I okay. would say.
Well, I'm reading like 7 books right now. I don't know if I can put another one in.
Are you sure? I don't know, Michael. One or two. You could probably do it, you know.
Well, I've actually started a series I found on like some Twitter, mm-hmm. like some small Catholic Twitter like account where he like suggested like a series of books to read on Christian Neoplatonism.
Ah.
And so like it's like 12 books long. It's on my Goodreads. And I'm on book one right now currently. So I'm reading it's a book called Theophany. What's the name? So it's called Theophany, the Neoplatonic Philosophy of Dionysus the Areopagite. And
it's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. And I like it.
You were sending me some of those passages, and a lot of it was
it's outstanding. Yeah, yeah. I'm really enjoying it. It's very different, kind of like I think we're kind of used to like, you know, scholasticism.
More Thomistic approach.
This is we both really don't know a whole lot about it. So like,
we would have to do a whole episode on it, I think, because it's
multiple episodes. Multiple. But like, so from the way I understand is like Neoplatonism heavily influenced Duns Scotus and kind of his own philosophy, and as a result, kind of like you have the more Franciscan school of thought, which tends to be more involved with like, you know, Duns Scotus, you know, Bonaventure. And reading a book, a short collection of works of Bonaventure a few weeks ago, I was really just like, it was like unbelievably fantastically good.
just blew you away.
Blew me away. And I was like, man, like I really don't know anything about like kind of like the other different schools of thought within the Catholic tradition. Like, you know, like Aquinas-Augustine.
Aquinas-Augustine.
That's all we kind of...
And then like Pope John Paul II.
Yeah, it's Aquinas-Augustine, John Paul II. Okay. Yes. Like, obviously, great thinkers. They wrote a lot, and there's so much we can learn from them. But have you heard of Bonaventure? Saint Bonaventure.
I mean, the name sounded. I mean, like I vaguely knew who he was, but didn't know what he was about. Or
yeah, like he's a doctor of the church, a seraphic doctor. Mm-hmm. Just a fantastic writer. Great, you know, just a very spiritual individual, super intelligent. but you never hear like his writings talked about or like used to like defend theology or like talk like or use in reference to dogma or anything like that. You never hear about him. And he's a doctor of the church, and you know, like I just kind of just want to, I would like to explore more of the different ways of viewing the Christian religion, and this is one of them. So we'll see how it goes. So this is book 1 of 12, and I guess I'll make my way through.
Awesome. So. Yeah, that do go ahead, because it's what I'd be curious to see then, okay, as you compare the Thomistic schools, the Neoplatonist schools, and then someone like schools of thought related to, say, like Gregory Palamas of mm-hmm. like the more Orthodox or Eastern Catholic tradition. I'd be interested sort of to see like, because like I've heard Palamism is distinct from Thomism, but then some people are like, oh no, it's actually modern interpretation. Yeah, like okay. modern interpretation sometimes don't do him justice. So it'd be interested to see how the three of them kind of overlap, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like his main work, I think, is like the Triads or something.
Okay. I want to read him at some point. I know some Eastern Catholics venerate him. So I guess we can venerate him too privately.
Yeah, that's the way I've heard it explained is like some Orthodox saints you cannot revere liturgically, mm-hmm. like during a mass, but you can venerate them privately. Like I think I showed you this. There was a picture of an icon, this one Eastern Catholic had, where it was St. Francis of Assisi and then St. Seraphim of Sarov actually like holding hands in like this like... You know, there's like an
interesting thing. I don't remember that, but it sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. Do you want to go ahead and...
Yeah, I guess this is probably... Pretty, I mean, long, actually, wait. There is one more thing I want to throw in. There was one thing I read that was interesting, because I had a house-sitting job, so I had plenty of time on my hands.
Okay.
And I went ahead and I read Fratelli Tutti by Pope Francis.
Well, we're doing that at some point.
We are, yeah. I just thought it was...
Okay, what did you think? I read it a long time ago, before I read the other social justice encyclicals. So what did you think?
Like, I think I told you this, right? Like, he's right in essence about a lot of things, but sometimes the way he writes things, it just kind of, like, it's, you know, it's, it makes you wince a little bit, because you're like, you know, he's right. It's just sometimes the way he phrases things, it's...
Right. It can, like, if you don't have a good understanding of the other social encyclicals, it can seem a bit blunt.
Right. Just kind of over the top.
But blunt to the point of like you lose like a little bit of that subtlety, which you really need a lot when it comes to like Catholic theology. Mm-hmm. At least what I've noticed. Like
he's just very like upfront about it and to the point. He's like, I mean, not necessarily to the point, but like,
well, you know, he's like it's not as much like what he says, it's how he says it. That's kind of why I had a problem with it. It's like you're right, but like the way you're saying it just kind of reads a bit awkwardly.
It and, can
like,
be misinterpreted
really easily. That's kind of what I've like that's like been my critique of his for a long time, but like
it also was a lot longer than any of the other
it's like 300 something paragraphs.
It's like the other ones were like, you know, small short books. This one's like, this one that would fill like a whole book.
Well, we need to do that one after Dolphus, the Austrian patriarch, right?
Yeah,
that would be the next one. Then that'll knock us, well, that'll finish up our season.
Yeah,
what's our season after Catholicism in America?
Yeah,
okay.
Which that one will be, I think, very applicable.
I'm looking forward to getting to the council seasons where we read
every single major council.
Well, every council, not every major, every of them. Single every, one. Yeah,
that'll be a good one when we really dive into, see, you know, just reveal all the stuff that happened.
I think,
you know,
I got to the Second Council of Lyon back in like, but like that's like, I think like 12. There's 21, I believe.
I haven't read any of them, so I wouldn't know.
Okay. They're short. The earlier ones are really, or not really short. They're shorter.
Right, but it's
then
like,
you get to like Vatican II, which is going to need a whole season.
That one's going to be, that one might piss off some people a little bit.
Why? Just.
Well, just because, you know, you're going to have the.
Vatican II every episode.
Well, the,
well, we'll see.
Yeah, it'll be
good. I don't know how like how exciting a lot of people make it out to be. You know, I think, honestly, I think it's a lot more, like, it's not as interesting as people think. Like, yeah, the traditionalists would say, oh, it's, like, heretic, full of heretical.
The end of the church is
like, at the worst, Vatican II is heretical. And at best, it is, has weaponized and big, like,
ambiguity. Ambiguity. Wow, this has been way too long. Yeah. We need to.
So it's either one or two. And then you have the more liberal approach, where it's like, oh, this is a complete rupture from the church of the past, which is a good thing for them. Or it's like,
at least that's kind of, well, yeah, that's pretty much it. But really, I don't think like it's that interesting in the sense like it doesn't do any of those three things. Or maybe, you know, maybe ambiguous.
In some, well, like Timothy Gordon, who broke away from Taylor Marshall over some of the back and two stuff, like he said, he's like, when I actually sat down and read the documents, he's like, it really isn't as ambiguous as people make it out to be. And yeah. It's not in conflict.
Well, that's what I mean. It's just, it's not as interesting as people think it is. Mm-hmm. And I think, I remember like I was some person I knew was reading through, and he's like, I was sitting down talking about this with like my aunt who was like a Catholic at this, like during the 60s and 70s. And like, we were going through it and she was seemed very surprised. Not how dull and drab the documents were, but like, just like back then it was like, oh, this is the new church. This is like the revolution that's going to overturn the evil church. And we're going to bring in like the new springtime. Mm-hmm. And now, like now they're actually seeing through it. It's like, man, this like really wasn't like as
it was this like fiery revolutionary document. It was just a church.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm curious to see what we get into. I've read a few of the documents, so who knows? This is like months from now.
Should we? Yeah, I mean, because I think like Vatican I would be a good place to end off of. You know, then the cliffhanger for Vatican II and then everything that went after that. But
yeah, we'll see. So okay, I think this is a good.
Yeah, so the end of our next Casual Saturday. The next one we'll be discussing
Casual Wednesday.
Casual Wednesday then. The next one, we'll be discussing the document that Francis sent out regarding the Latin Mass and sort of our take on the whole thing mm-hmm. and what we think this means for the future of the church for a while. So, yeah, this has been The Weekly Papist. We're your hosts, Giovanni Del Piero and Michael Pekka, and we hope you have a good day.
Yep. So, see you guys.
Great to be back.
Yep. Bye.